Hello and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. Amongst the choices, well, you can catch up on a bit of David Lynch with Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire, some winter chills from The Wicker Man and Orphan, or how about a few laughs, courtesy of Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa and the Lavender Hill Mob. We're doing our very best to explore it all in this podcast. This time, we're getting in the Christmas spirit with the help of 1952's The Holly and the Ivy. And I'm delighted to be joined for this episode by cultural historian Professor Sir Christopher Frayling, who's chosen the movie as one of his festive favourites. Here's a clip from it to get us in the right frame of mind.
There's something about Christmas morning.
In a vicarage, with services from 6 o'clock onwards, there's no morning at all.
No, but the first moment when you wake up. Somehow I don't know why you always know it's Christmas morning. It's as if during the night, while you were asleep, something had happened. You even expect the world to look as different as it feels. And you lie there, taking it in and realizing, and this seems strangest of all, that it's Christmas everywhere.
A big hello to you, Professor Sir Christopher Frayling. Can I call you Professor Sir?
I think Christopher would be very
Christopher.
Nice. Thank you very
hello,
much.
Christopher.
Hi there.
A very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. All of our guests on this show, we like just to introduce them by getting them to tell us a little fact about themselves, how you got into film, particular favourites, anything like that. Did you come armed for us?
The first film I ever saw was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the Walt Disney version, near Oxford Circus. And I was so frightened by the witch, remember, with warty nose and eat this apple and all that, that I was taken out of the cinema shaking. And my mother had to take me on the Circle Line going round and round in the tube to simmer me down because I was really, overheated by this film. And in a way, I've been going round and round in circles ever since. So it's that was my origin of film.
So we're here talking about 1952's The Holly and the Ivy. I mean, it's a Christmas film, but it's not one that appears on too many people's lists, really. But I gather it's firmly on yours. So can you introduce the film for us?
Well, The Holly and the Ivy was part of an experiment that the producer Alexander Korda, who ran London Films, had in 1950, which was to take a West End success, a play, and rehearse it at Shepperton Studios for 3 weeks with the actors, usually with a different cast to that on the stage, with some stars and so on.
Yeah.
And then shoot it very quickly in 2 weeks, sort of 5 week turnaround, and put them into the cinemas in the hope that in that process the plays would become something a bit different. They weren't just filmed drama, they were films, they worked as films. And the first one was called Home at Seven, which is the only film ever directed by Ralph Richardson.
We're coming to him, aren't we?
We're coming to him. Yep. And he appeared on the stage in this play and he actually directed the film. And the fourth one was The Holly and the Ivy. It was a huge success in the West End, started off at the Lyric Hammersmith and went to the St. Martin's Theatre, ran for 18 months. And why I love it is it's a very intelligent film about the meaning of Christmas, with lots of discussions about a whole spectrum of attitudes. Everyone in the film dislikes Christmas and they all say why. But of course, by the end, they begin to see its value in all sorts of different ways. In fact, when the film came out in the United States, the bits which discussed atheism were actually cut. It was too strong for American audiences. So, you know, it's quite a sort of serious film. It's not like a Christmas special.
Yeah.
And yes, it's a film play, but it's also an insight into a very particular generation of actors. There's Celia Johnson, who plays the daughter of a Norfolk vicar. They call him the parson throughout. They don't call him a vicar or a priest. He's always the parson. And she'd just come out of Brief Encounter. And in a way, the character she plays is very related to the character she'd played as Laura in Brief Encounter. And one of the reviewers of The Holly and the Ivy in The Herald said, this film is even better than Brief Encounter. So at the time, it was actually very, very well reviewed. Since then, it's rather been submerged and disappeared from the public view.
That's interesting. I mean, the point you said there about they took the theatrical production and brought it to the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, is that right down to the sets? Because even watching it now, because I watched it for the first time ahead of us recording this, and I'm looking at it just see parts of it look like it's been lifted out of a theatre.
Yeah, I think that certainly the idea of the sets, but then they open it out. You know, it begins with everyone looking in shop windows at turkeys and geese and toys and so on for Christmas, the vicarage in Norfolk where it takes place, the carol singers, trains going to Norfolk. And in fact, there's some really interesting bits about London at the beginning where the idea is that all these relatives have been invited to this this vicarage in Norfolk for Christmas, and all the family tensions are going to come out. And you're introduced to them in different parts of London. One is next to the Albert Memorial. You get a lovely shot of the Albert Memorial in 1952. Another is in St. James's Clubland. So you've got all that St. James's street stuff. Like a lot of these films, you get a lot of detail in the background. So these are documentary shots. The main thing that I think makes it differ from the theatrical version is the use of close-ups. There's a very famous scene in this film where they're in the kitchen. The two ladies are washing up, of course.
Yep.
The two daughters, one played by Celia Johnson and one played by Margaret Leighton. And now the men aren't in the room. They're actually being candid with each other. They've decided the gloves are off and they're going to actually admit what they really feel about this experience of being there on Christmas Eve.
The aunts say you're fed up with being at home. That's not true, is it?
Why shouldn't it be true?
Then it is.
The big revelation is that the Margaret Leighton character has been pregnant. She's lost her son to meningitis, and she hasn't told the family about it at all. She's also a fashionista. She's a fashion journalist and hates the job that she does. But she tells this with her back to the camera, facing the curtain. And the whole thing is how it registers on the face of Celia Johnson as she hears this news.
Yes, of course.
So she starts off being rather disapproving.
I'm longing to see him. How old is he now?
Then she's shocked.
He had been 5 last September. Would have been.
And then she's very emotionally engaged in the story and very, very sympathetic.
He was only 4.
And that's a series of close-ups of the eyes, these rather large eyes, very expressive eyes of Celia Johnson. Now, that's not theatrical. There's moments in the film. There's another moment a bit later in the story where the son, played by Denham Elliott, this wayward son who's doing national service in the Royal Artillery, comes back home and is very rude to his dad. And they're in the middle of a blazing row. And dad stands on one side of the Christmas tree and Denham Elliott stands on the other. And they're talking to each other through the branches of the Christmas tree, so they can't quite see each other. And it's utter non-communication between two people with this Christmas tree. So there's moments where they really have thought it out. The director, George Morrow Ferrell, is not a very well-known director, specialised in the 1950s in armchair theatre on television.
Oh, okay.
You know, the origin of the TV play.
Yeah, yeah.
So he is trying to think it out visually. But yes, I mean, there's long speeches. The setting, as you say, is very, very theatrical. And you never forget that it's a well-made play. It's a three-act play. It's largely set in a drawing room. It's upper middle class. It's everything that theatre was in the West End before 1956 and Look Back in Anger came along and altered the whole theatrical picture. So it's a kind of peep show of what theatre was like in the early 50s.
You've neglected to mention the wall full of pictures of cats as well.
Oh, yes, yes, one of
incredible
the aunts.
Incredible detail in some of these sets.
Yes, one of the aunts, and it's Dandy Nichols of Till Death Us Do Part. She looks after the cats while Aunt Bridget goes to Norfolk for Christmas.
Not going away for Christmas? Oh, dear, why ever not?
I can't leave Blossom. Does seem a shame you're losing your Christmas holidays just for the sake of a cat. I suppose you wouldn't trust him with me, would you?
With you? You know, I believe I would.
Well, I'm only next door. And you do so enjoy going to your brother's for Christmas, don't you?
You said that nobody really wants to do Christmas, and so, but that you've got the bit at the start where there are people who clearly do want to come together for Christmas.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the first shots in the film is this hand posting the invitations, isn't it, to an old-fashioned postbox. And they all turn out, yes, we must be there. You know, we always spend Christmas with Dad or with Uncle or with, you know, whoever it is. But once they get there, the gloves are off.
Yes.
You know, they're in this concentrated, rather oddly designed vicarage with small rooms. So they're a very sort of compressed area. And all the repressions come out. One of the themes is that everyone assumes you can't say controversial things in front of Dad, not least because he's 70, he's a vicar, and he's going to take it badly, which is patronising him. And he, towards the end, he realises what an awful thing that you feel you can't say these things. Because when they do actually blurt them out, he's quite sympathetic and understanding.
But do you think because I'm a parson, I know nothing about life? Why do you think I was ordained in the first place? Do you think it was because I was so easily shocked that I couldn't face realities?
So it's this thing about repression, and that's the relationship with Brief Encounter, you know, that repressed people who find it very, very difficult to express emotions, and they're just on the cusp of saying what's really on their mind, but not able to spit it out, which Celia Johnson was brilliant at.
Yeah.
You know I can't leave Father.
That's absurd, of course you can.
Darling, it's not absurd. There's no one else. I must look after him. Can't you understand? I must.
The period that it's set in, it's Christmas Eve 1948, although the film came out in 1952, and all sorts of things are going on. Austerity, you know, just coming out of the war, rationing, the rubble of London, etc., etc. Commercialisation is beginning. Macmillan is shortly to make his speech about we've never had it so good. And you're on the cusp of going out of austerity into plenty.
Yeah.
And that's one of the themes. Obviously, the youngsters taking over from the old generation is a major theme, you know, with all their dreams and ambitions and getting some agency in their lives when all sorts of things are expected of them, but they don't want to do that anymore. So, you know, there's a new kind of society that's emerging. You can see these themes. It's very much of its moment. All the celebration of 1951, the Festival of Britain, you know, rah-rah for Britain, rah-rah for technology and so on. It's not like that. This is quite a dark film. Rather like It's a Wonderful Life. In a way, this is the British It's a Wonderful Life. Instead of Bedford Falls, a Norfolk village. But there's a dark side to Christmas, as well as all the community and the carol singing and the joy and all the rest of it. And it's trying to do, and It's a Wonderful Life, I think.
Well, for the first 45 minutes, I'm sat thinking, this is a genial, likeable Christmas film. Sing-song, family coming together. Yeah. And then, I mean, what you said about the three-act play makes perfect sense with it. It's just like the back 20, 25 minutes dramatically changed the film for me.
Yeah.
Really, the tonal and, shift and what it was actually doing.
And one of the cinematic things about the film is that all the imagery, all the sort of iconography of Christmas, the decorating the house, the carol singers, the shop windows, the snow, midwinter, and all those sort of things are contrasted with the attitudes to what's going on. So all that glitz and jollity is absolutely in contrast to the people that are living within it, which you wouldn't have got on the stage.
Yeah.
It's a kind of visual contrast. It's more cinematic than people think, I think, the holly and the... And indeed, the imagery of the holly and the ivy runs right through it. The carol keeps reappearing. There's a big speech about, doesn't holly smell ghastly? You know, when you break the stem, says Celia Johnson, it smells horrible. And then the vicar says, I'm preparing a sermon on the folkloric origins of Christmas. So the symbolism is quite... And a holly is prickly. It may look beautiful, but all that, it's a strong image, hence the title.
Oh, it goes right back to the old nature worship, the struggle between the holly and the ivy. There's a lot about it here in this book. The holly was the young men, the ivy was the girls. There was a struggle between them as to who should rule the house.
I know who rules in this house.
I was talking to our producer, Jane, who never gets a name check on this podcast, but 19 episodes in, I thought I should do that. And we were discussing the fact that the film's got alcoholism, faith, it's got deception, it's got sex, it's got relationships. So I was asking, is it kind of like a modern, would Mike Lee be tackling stuff like this now? She suggested that this is the EastEnders Christmas special, isn't it? In 1950s cinematic form.
In some respects. I mean, there are some, they all go to church at the end.
Yeah, and sing. They have a sing song at
the
end.
Yes, they do. And as the Christmas bells peal out, the vicar says very wisely, you know, how absurd life is, which is a kind of reference to what's been going on for the last hour and a half. Yeah, it would make a great Mike Lee thing, actually. But you could even set it in the kitchen, I think. They'd all be in there sort of tearing strips off each other and so on. It seems to have been a novel that's just been reprinted by Kathleen Farrell called Mistletoe Malice, written in 1951. It's just been reissued. And it also takes this idea of the family, in this case a matriarch rather than a patriarch, invites son and daughter, and they just spend 4 days tearing each other to pieces. It's a great dysfunctional family Christmas. I don't know why in 1951, too, there was this great urge to do this to Christmas, but I suppose there'd been so much sentimentality just after the war about Christmas and, you know, the boys are coming home let's have the most wonderful Christmas we've had since 1939. Maybe this was, the pendulum was swinging. So by 1952, hang on a minute, it isn't all jollity. There's lots of contradictions, lots of problems. And actually, when you put families together, it's pretty explosive. By Christmas Day, anyway. Christmas Eve may be all right.
Yeah.
By Christmas Day, the cracks are beginning to show. That seems to have been in the ether in 1952.
I think I speak on behalf of all listeners when I say that we're noting the fact that you have a semi-addiction to stories about families beating themselves up on Christmas Day.
Indeed. Well, I think we've all experienced it, haven't we?
Ah, what an absurd world it is. The Christmas bells. Peace on earth, goodwill towards men. And here have I been losing my temper and shouting at you. I beg your pardon, Bridget.
The heart of this particular film is Reverend Martin Gregory, as you said, played by Ralph Richardson. Mm. But what do you get, for those not familiar with Ralph Richardson, what do you get when you bring him into a film?
The reviewers, he'd been in quite a lot of,
yeah, of
major films, from Things to Come, The Ghoul, and various other things onwards from the 1930s. But he was normally, at that stage, very theatrical in film, rather like early Laurence Olivier films. He overdid it. He overacted for the camera. And a lot of the reviewers said about this film that he was unusually restrained. It's quite a low-key performance, absent-minded, a bit doddery. He plays a 70-year-old. He was, in fact, 50 at the time. They give him white hair.
I know how he feels there.
And so, you know, he had this, he was beginning to develop this persona of the slightly curmudgeonly, slightly dotty, rather lovable old man, which he lived with for the rest of his career. And this is one of the first examples of it. He never feels like 70, I don't think, in the film. I mean, although he's got white hair, he seems a little bit youthful. On the other hand, Celia Johnson, who was supposed to be 31 in the film, was in fact 44. So she's almost Ralph Richardson's age, and she's supposed to be his younger daughter. But so the age thing was a bit on. No, everyone complimented Ralph Richardson, or it may be Rafe Richardson, I'm never quite sure. But anyway, Ralph Richardson, on at last understanding the camera and taking it down a few notches and taking the volume down as well, that he didn't bellow at the camera. It's quite a subtle performance, I think, particularly this transformation from, he seems sort of dotty and absent-minded and not really on the ball. And then suddenly you realise, about two-thirds of the way, he's a very perceptive man. He knows exactly what's going on all around him, but he wants the kids to sort it out for themselves. He's not going to intervene. What they interpreted it as, him being not interested, particularly Denham Elliot. By the way, The Shape of Things to Come in this film, Denham Elliot is doing national service. His regimental sergeant major is William Hartnell, the first Doctor Who.
I have to get Doctor Who into absolutely every episode of this.
And in fact, it was William Hartnell, you know, appearing in the Army Game on television and Carry On Sergeant. He specialised in regimental sergeant majors, that actually got him cast as Doctor Who. So there's a direct connection between this movie and the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who.
Please, sir.
Well, what is it?
About that passage. It's rather important I should get home for Christmas.
Oh, no, it isn't. You're in the army now. There's nothing important about you.
Right, sir. I want to see the major, please.
Well, you can't.
William Hartnell, when he turned up, I was in Doctor Who heaven. Full-on grumpiness as well.
Yeah, although there's a nice smile, isn't there? He seems horrible, and he puts Denham Elliot on a charge, and then they agree to let him out for Christmas, and there's a broad smile. Yes, absolutely, you have to do that. So, like Doctor Who, he sort of seems rather a tough character, but actually underneath it, he's soft as anything.
That'll be the aunt.
Well, you've got Maureen Delaney as well as Aunt Bridget, who feels like the grumpy relative who turns up at every Christmas.
Siberia, it's like Siberia.
Did you forget we were coming or what?
Yes, she was one of the only two characters who were in the West End play, were transposed to the film, and it was the two aunts. They were the original cast from the play version. All the rest were specially cast for the film. No, she's great. Aunt Bridget, one of the aunts, is a bit like sort of Miss Havisham.
Yep.
And the other aunt is like a character out of P.G. Woodhouse, you know, that she's rather sort of fey, elderly, wears fur, says all sorts of rather wonderful aphorisms about the good old days and so on. They're rather wonderful grand dame of the British theatre, really giving it some welly. You know, it makes me wish that I'd seen the actual play, because if that was the kind of quality of the play, then it must have been worth seeing, I think.
Well, it's the two aunts who are in the worst mood who most want to be there.
Yes, but they remind us of quite an interesting thing about this film. Although it looks very English, Aunt Bridget is Irish. We learn that the vicar was brought up in Dublin. Mm. So most unusually, he's an Anglo-Irish Anglican. So he's brought up in Dublin but becomes an Anglican vicar. And in fact, the author of the play Wynyard Brown, now completely forgotten, but he was a playwright and novelist. He was indeed Anglo-Irish.
Yeah.
His dad was born in Dublin. His dad became a vicar in Norfolk. And he had two aunts who resembled Aunt Bridget and Aunt Lydia. So a lot of it was autobiographical for this man. So it seems English, but you got that Celtic thing of the Anglo-Irish and Aunt Bridget. It comes over from Ireland, basically,
yeah.
And has a lot of very traditional rural Irish values. And the boyfriend of Celia Johnson is from Aberdeen. He's Scottish. So what you've got is a very English setting with the Brits all coming together, Scottish, Irish, Celtic, and not getting on. So there's a kind of state of the nation element going on here that, you know, does the UK work or is it English? And can we all settle our differences and perhaps have, you know, actually civilised conversations over Christmas Eve dinner with the Celtic fringe? There's a bit of that going on.
So was there any pushback when it was released? Because the themes are quite daring and what it's got going on under the surface is quite daring, yeah, as
apparently
well.
Apparently not. I mean, the reviews basically said, this is excellent film theatre. I mean, some people thought it was great that it was film theatre. Some of the more movie-minded reviewers said, what a pity it's film theatre. But they all seemed to agree that it was film theatre,
yeah,
and a very, very good example of that. But in the States, it was very controversial and was cut because some of the speeches about how cinema's taken over from the church, how everyone's lost their faith and the retailers and brewers have taken over, all that stuff was a bit strong for them, so they cut them. It was an 80-minute movie in the United States.
Wait a minute. So lovely. Strange how sound can be so beautifully still.
You know, I had the most extraordinary experience recently. I went to a reception a couple of months ago and I met this woman. I said to her, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you have a really strong resemblance to the actress Celia Johnson. And she said, I'm her daughter.
My life.
It was Celia Johnson's daughter, by chance. Life. She had the eyes, that very, very expressive eyes. Yeah, no, it was extraordinary. It was uncanny, actually. It really was uncanny. So I've been watching out for sort of Celia Johnson performances.
Yeah.
I mean, the late Terence Davis reckoned that her performance as Laura in Brief Encounter was his favourite film performance of all time. The over-enunciated vowels get in the way.
Yeah.
Some people have referred rather unflatteringly to irritable vowel syndrome.
Very good.
Thank you very
much. 8 out of 10.
Which does get in the way. But visually, she's got the most... Noel Coward, you know, referred to the magic of her highly expressive eyes as something that he hadn't encountered with any other actor that he'd worked with. And this is why it's unfair, I think, to categorise it as just film theatre, because yeah, her eyes are the star of the show.
I suppose people who fall asleep in the snow feel like this. They know they've got to keep awake, but just for a moment they give up the struggle because the snow's so warm.
Just to put minds at rest for people listening, do you make a habit of going up to people at parties and asking them if they're Celia Johnson's
daughter?
No, I don't. Was that the first?
But it was so extraordinary. It was... she really does resent... Anyway, yeah, no,
I don't do that.
She took it rather well, actually.
Yeah.
And we then discussed how her mum is rather out of fashion now, possibly from Brief Encounter, but she'd done a lot of stage work. In fact, as part of the Festival of Britain in 1951, there was a special production put on, funded by the Arts Council, at the Aldwych Theatre of The Three Sisters. And what was the cast? The lead was Ralph Richardson, and two of the sisters were Margaret Leighton and Celia Johnson. The same cast as this movie had just finished the Chekhov Three Sisters before they started making this film. I did see Celia Johnson on the stage, actually, latterly, when she was a sort of grand dame of the theatre, but not in her heyday. And she didn't export, and the result is she didn't become a superstar.
To the page and stand by me, if thou knowst it telling.
It's interesting what you said there about she's gone out of fashion a little bit, because one of the things about the Holly and the Ivy is the ensemble throughout is strong, but if you search for all of the actors in it, it's not listed as one of their top three most popular films, is it? It's just kind of bubbled down.
And I think one of the things, because it's in an upper middle class setting, people think, well, it's not diverse enough. But actually, A Christmas Carol by Dickens, yes, you've got street life, but it's an upper middle class setting or in a middle class setting. And, you know, the great Christmas story is basically a story about a miserly middle class person who sees the error of his ways. And it hasn't affected that.
Yeah.
Somehow, you know, it's got in the way, I think, of the appreciation of this film. Now, let's hear it for The Holly and the Ivy. Listen, if you want an intelligent, quite challenging Christmas movie that still has things to say to us about what we're doing when we celebrate Christmas, then this is the movie for you. You know, Gremlins it ain't, but...
Well, maybe we should do a version of it with the Muppets in.
Kermit in a dog collar, you
I reckon? Think so. He's done that before, I believe.
Has he? Yeah, all right, okay. I don't remember that bit, yes.
If I can just tie up Reverend Gregory.
Yes.
Because the pastor character in it is the one who's examining what's described as the caricature of religion.
All the sermons in the year, the one on Christmas morning I dislike. Nobody wants to hear you. They're all fidgeting in their pews, longing to be back home, basting the Christmas goose. There's no time to be telling them anything important.
It's not kind of what I was expecting from a Christmas movie and from a man of the cloth who is drawing our attention to the difficulty of his world, if you like.
I know. And, you know, and someone says, well, you've got to go and talk to the children. He goes, oh, really? Do I have to? But yes, at the beginning of the film, as people arrive, Denham Elliot, young sort of next generation young man doing national service, comes in and says how much he loved Christmas when he was a child, but now he finds it utterly boring. And each of the characters expresses a sort of aversion of that. And you think, you know, the vicar's going to come in and say, give us the good news.
Yeah.
Instead of which, he says, do you know, I hate it. It's all eating and drinking, and the people have completely forgotten in the commercialisation. And that's extraordinary, really, for Christmas Eve 1948. You imagine people saying that post-1960s, really, with the sort of marketisation of everything and the commercialisation. But, you know, he's rather surprisingly, he's a bit on the ball. He feels it, he says, when he gives his sermons, that everyone's thinking, ah, it's a bit naff going on about, you know, the birth of Christ and the Nativity at this time of year. We want to get back and do some partying. He says he feels that in the congregation. It's extraordinary, really. And that's the bit that the Americans found too strong.
I always think Christmas is the loveliest of the festivals.
Do you know I hate it?
Martin, why?
Ah, the brewers and the retail traders have got hold of it. It's all eating and drinking and giving each other knick-knacks. Nobody remembers the birth of Christ.
Before we move off the holly and the ivy and onto your double bill, is there anything else we should look out for in the film?
Well, I think there's one more filmic aspect of it, and that's the soundtrack, the music. It's basically a fantasia of famous carols rearranged by Malcolm Arnold. And it weaves together these carols played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. It's a fantastic score, actually. It's the kind of thing you might expect to hear at the last night of the proms if it didn't take place in the summer. You know, instead of a fantasia of sea songs, a fantasia of carols. And that you'd never get in the theatre. So, yes, you've got these visual touches and you've also got this soundtrack, which makes it much more of a filmic experience.
So is it all round to your house on Christmas Eve for a special watch party? And a sing-along screening as well.
That's the one. That's the one, a ball bouncing over the words, the holly and the ivy.
There you go. I've got Professor Sir Christopher Frayling singing for you. What more could you ask? Before we wrap things up, what we ask of all of our guests as well is just to dig into the Studio Canal catalogue for us for a double bill you'd recommend to the people listening. And I gather you've got a couple of 1950s-ish films for us.
Yes. Firstly, we've talked about the Festival of Britain, 1951, and the official film industry contribution to the Festival of Britain was a film called The Magic Box, which is all about, in quotes, the inventor of cinematography, William Freeze Green, a Bristolian who patented a movie camera in the late 1880s. It's basically a celebration of his life story with everybody you can imagine appearing in a cameo, you know, that if you blink, you miss Richard Attenborough or you miss Peter Ustinov or, you know, and I'm still looking for some of them, but they are there in the background. So it's a kind of celebration of Brit. But what's so interesting about it is that unlike a Hollywood biopic, which is always about, you know, adversity in the first act and triumph in the second act, this film is downhill all the way. William Freeze Green ends up bankrupt. His marriage has collapsed. None of his inventions have been rated. Everyone's accusing him of plagiarism. And he drops down dead at a seminar about film at the Connaught Rooms in London. It's the polar opposite of a Hollywood biopic. Very, very British. We set them up, we knock them down. And they certainly knock them down in this one. The most famous scene is Laurence Olivier playing PC-94B, who is said to be the first person ever to see moving pictures projected on a screen. So he goes to see William Freeze Green in the back streets of Holborn, and Freeze Green invites him in, and the policeman sits there, played by Laurence Olivier, and he sees these flickering images. That's Hyde Park. How did that get there? Where's it gone? Good heavens, you must be a very happy man, Mr. Freeze Green, which is the horse's laugh, because at that point he's about the unhappiest man in England. But it's a famous scene. It never happened, But nevertheless, it's quite a moment.
Here, look. That's where the Hyde Park you saw is.
But it moved.
Yes, it moved, didn't it? It's taken me years to get to that. Years.
Mark, what do you do?
The other is Peeping Tom, which I think is one of the greats, actually. You know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about Powell and Pressburger, big season of their films and restorations of them and books coming out and everything. But this was a film that Michael Powell made after having had a row with Pressburger and starting out on his own. And it is quite extraordinary. I mean, it was the same year as Psycho.
Yep.
So Peeping Tom comes out in May 1960. Psycho comes out in September 1960. Psycho is a huge commercial hit. Peeping Tom disappears almost as soon as it appeared because it got such bad reviews in the press, one of whom said this film should have immediately been flushed down the toilet. Actually said that the distributors lost their nerve and dumped it. It's a remarkable film. It is just as sensitive a portrait of a serial killer as Anthony Perkins, only this is a man called Mark Lewis who goes around filming people and he kills them with a stiletto knife attached to his camera and photographs them in their dying moments. It's an extraordinary idea. But what's really interesting about Peeping Tom is that it's a movie about movie making. Scorsese has said it's his favourite film about movie making. It's basically about a guy who can't get the shot that he wants throughout the film. So he goes to more and more extreme measures to get the shot that he wants. And Scorsese's favourite line in the film is Maxine Audley, the lady who lives downstairs, "All this filming, it's not good for you."
My interest is in the fear.
Have you gone crazy?
Yes.
And we're actually going to be talking about Peeping Tom in the next episode as well, but you'll be too busy with your Christmas.
Yeah, I was mortified that you haven't asked me to talk about Peeping Tom. But
to be honest, you've petrified me with your talk of a camera with a knife on the end.
Can I tell you just a little story? I went to the London location of Peeping Tom, one of them, Newman Passage, Rathbone Place, is very like what it was in the movie. In fact, the pub is still there. I went through the arch and I was standing in front of the building where the prostitute lives in the first scene of Peeping Tom. And I was looking at it, taking a photo of it, and someone came up to me and they made whirring noises like this, pretending to be Mark Lewis. It was a fellow Peeping Tom buff who knew exactly what I was doing.
Don't take this the wrong way. You're definitely not coming on the next episode for my own personal safety. Professor Sir Christopher Frayling, it's been a delight having you here. And
thank
your
you very
selection
much. I've enjoyed
of very
it.
Upbeat films.
Ding dong merrily on high. That's
Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Thank you very much.
The Holly and the Ivy is available to buy on DVD and Blu-ray and via video on demand services. Now it's time for our regular news update from the world of Studio Canal. A quick reminder to start with, if you're listening to this just before Christmas, that Santa Claus the Movie is back in UK cinemas at the moment. It's getting its widest cinema release since the 1980s, and the film is now available, fully restored, on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. Also out, a pair of recent acclaimed Studio Canal movies. Celine Song's Past Lives and Ken Loach's The Old Oak are available in time for Christmas on DVD and Blu-ray. Extra features are included too, and expect to see one or two of the films involved in the current movie awards season. The film you just heard me talking about with Christopher Frayling, Peeping Tom, well, that's coming to disc early next year with a new 4K remaster. The restoration is courtesy of the Martin Scorsese Film Foundation, and you'll be able to get your hands on the disc from early 2024. Here's a date to put in your diary as well. Back to Black is the upcoming film that tells the story of the late Amy Winehouse. Sam Taylor Johnson is directing the movie, which stars Marissa Abella as Winehouse. The film has the support of the Amy Winehouse estate, and the release date, April the 12th, 2024. We'll have more on the film in a future episode of the Studio Canal Presents podcast. Don't forget, too, that Wicked Little Letters, starring Jesse Buckley and Olivia Colman, of which more in the next episode, is coming to cinemas on February the 23rd, 2024. Very much looking forward to that one, too. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Letterboxd, Instagram and TikTok. For now, from all of us here, a very happy Christmas and a very movie-filled new year. Ho, ho, ho.